Hello, I'm Beth Kesselman, and this is Smashing the Ceiling, a podcast on social hiring and a St. Stephen's Community House production. Thanks for joining us. St. Stephen's Community House acknowledges that our locations are situated upon traditional territories of the Wendat, Anishinaabeg Nation, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations, and the Métis Nation. The treaty that was signed for this particular parcel of land is collectively referred to as the Toronto Purchase and applies to lands east of Brown's Line to Woodbine Avenue and north towards Newmarket. St. Stephen's Community House is a guest, and we recognize the enduring presence of the Indigenous peoples on this land. Welcome back to another episode of Smash the Ceiling, a podcast on social hiring. Before we begin, don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is @PeerPathwaysTO for both. This month, we've been very fortunate to have Tara Piercy and David Odie from the Center for Addiction and Mental Health's Social Determinants of Health team come on and talk about disability, disclosure, and accommodation. St. Stephen's is happy to be a community partner with KMH, and we are excited that David and Tara could join us for this episode. Giving and receiving accommodations has always been a bit of a dance for both employers and employees. Every business and every individual has a different experience with these types of delicate conversations and has a different level of comfort with them. And at some point, people on both sides of this conversation have had questions about accommodation. What are a person's rights? How do you define what accommodations are needed? If you're seeking an accommodation, how much information do you really need to give? And what is the best time to have these conversations? And finally, what happens after an accommodation has been set up? So I'm so happy that David and Tara can shed some light on these important questions.
So my name's Tara Piercy, and I'm an occupational therapist at KMH. And I'm here with David Odie, who's a social worker, and we're both on the Social Determinants of Health Service, which is one of the teams at KMH. We're a fairly small team, and we really focus on the social determinants of health, as our name suggests. Our mandate is to provide KMH clients with access to services in four of the determinants of health: housing, income, employment, and education. And we do that in a few different ways. One of the ways is through the development of partnerships with agencies in the community in those four areas to promote access for our clients. And so we have a great partnership with St. Stephen's, which is how we've gotten to know you guys there, and we're really happy with that. So through the partnership we have with you guys, we're able to connect clients directly with employment support services to help them gain access to employment if that's their end goal. With the service. So we also work to enhance the capacity of the community around mental health. So we go, we do provide some introductory mental health education sessions to our community partners. We also provide some education to the community around mental health with the goal of reducing stigma so that we lower barriers to our clients accessing services in the community. And we work with frontline clinicians here at KMH to enhance their capacity in those four areas as well, so that they can help their clients with those goals. So we choose to focus on four of the determinants of health. We don't exclude any of the others. There are
14
of them. But we focus on those four areas because we know through the work that we do that the clients that access services at KMH often have many barriers to accessing those four areas. And yet we also know that if those barriers were mitigated or even just reduced, that their health, just like all of our health, would be greatly improved. So,
can you give like a brief overview of why, of what social determinants of health is?
Well, I think the traditional definition is that they are factors, 14 of them, that everyone, every human being, is born into and grows up in, whatever culture they're in, and these factors have massive effects on their quality of life, their health, their length of life, all those things. And they're sort of out there in the world, external factors, and have this huge amount of control, so that obviously people's will to do things and grow and stuff is important as well, but it has to take place within the context of all these social determinants of health. So does that?
Yeah. Yeah. Just like the name suggests, they determine people's health. So if people have access to all 14 of them, generally they're fairly healthy. But once you start taking things away from, taking some of the determinants away from people through the life circumstances or what have you, then people's health starts to decline.
One of the obvious examples, the example we often use because of its power, is simply the connection between income and length of life.
Mm-hmm.
That the higher a person's income, the longer they're going to live. And that's something that's a worldwide phenomena. How it happens, obviously, is much more complicated than just talking about it, but it is true. It's true in Toronto. It's true on the other side of the world, too.
Mm-hmm. In addition, so we have this great partnership with St. Stephen's. We also have partnerships with other employment agencies. Mostly, though, the partnerships we have all sort of look similar in terms of employment. We're really just helping clients gain access to the employment supports that do exist in the community so that they can receive that assistance that they need to help with whatever their employment goals are. So maybe it's brushing up their resume, maybe it's connecting them with certain employment, or maybe it's providing support on the job if they need that. The other work that we've done, we just started doing this a few years ago, through the help of our employment partners, we've hosted an employment fair for CAMH clients. And this fair takes place on CAMH grounds, and we have managed to invite over 50 vendors to our fair in the last few years, from employers who are hiring to employment support agencies to educational facilities that have more of a focus around mental health, with the goal of really helping clients meet their employment goals at any stage of readiness and in recovery that they're in. So maybe they're just thinking of employment, maybe they're ready for employment. And so we can tell you through the experience that we've had, you know, we often have over 200 clients attend that fair. So the clients that we work with at CAMH are really wanting employment. They're, you know, in various stages of recovery, but employment is often a goal of clients. And so the topic of accommodation and disclosure, which we're going to talk to you today, is something that's pretty prevalent in a lot of the work that we do.
And so what are the key things that are important when you have those conversations?
It often depends on where the person's at and what kind of questions they have. Quite frequently, people don't have, because they've either never been in the workforce or have been out of the workforce for a long time, you know, some of it is as simple as not having the vocabulary. How would I say this and that? How would you express yourself? And, of course, disclosure comes up in that, too. What's interesting I've found over my 17 years here is that quite frequently if we talk to clients about issues of disclosure, it's more often that we're trying to get them to not say as much rather than what it is that they have to say, because it's not unusual for a person who's been in the system for a long time and has had teams of people interested in their mental and physical health and their well-being to then go out into the world, the wider world, where people are not as interested in a stranger's or an employee's current state of feeling or how they're doing and things like that. So quite frequently that comes up about, you know, what do you need to say and what don't you need to say around disclosure. So that's an interesting aspect that I've found here. I think central to the idea of disclosure is do you need to say anything at all? Why would you disclose to someone? And when might you make that disclosure if you feel that you need to talk about yourself or your past history? I would say for the majority of people, there's really only one occasion where you need to disclose anything about your health concerns, mental or physical, and that's really if you're asking for some type of accommodation, because accommodation does require that you're asking an employer to make a slight adjustment for a short period of time to lower or get rid of a barrier to the person learning the job or learning a new function on the job, those kinds of very specific circumstances. So by and large, for most clients that I've dealt with here, they don't really need to say anything about their mental health histories. If they're going for a job and they've had some help and they understand that this is a job maybe they've done before or a job that they think they can do if trained properly, really that's the most important point when you go and talk to an employee, an employer, is not what your past is, but what your future is hoping to be like, and that future usually includes, I'd like to work part-time, or I'd like to work full-time for you, doing whatever it is that you require, and really that's, we focus on that being the most important thing. That person is applying for a job like anybody else that's applying for that job in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, and that's really what you're doing in an interview, is talking about how you would be that good employee for the person. So by and large, they don't have to talk about their past, because it's irrelevant really to what they're trying to do at that moment. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not always true, of course, but I mean, there are, so I've mentioned accommodation, another issue of disclosure that might come up. And it isn't necessarily associated with mental health and addictions, but and that is around criminal records. So there may be questions on job applications and things like that that ask if typically if you have any crimes that you've actually been convicted of that you haven't received a pardon for. So. So that's another issue that where they might have to, if they do have a conviction that hasn't been pardoned, they may have to disclose that issue. And there's two levels of that, really. It's there's the one which is sort of a the surface question, which is really to do only with convictions, not charges. So that may be a typical thing if you're handling money, or any store might ask you that just around the issue of worrying about theft of merchandise or those kinds of things. The second level, which is a deeper, and that's if an employer is allowed to ask about your past or look, do a police check at a deeper level if you're going to be involved with vulnerable people. So that could be seniors, children, those kinds of things. And that may show up some aspects of your psychiatric history. But those jobs would be few and far between, I think. And that would be something that you would think that a counselor or with our help would be asking them about, because they wouldn't, part of your job, you wouldn't want to go into a business or into a job that you've had difficulty if with vulnerable people before, or that you've committed a criminal act, or even if you were found not criminally responsible. So chances are that a person wouldn't return to a type of industry where they had problems before, but would be looking for a new industry. So the question about whether they would have to disclose is also mitigated by the fact that chances are they're likely not going back to the same line of work that they were in before.
Yeah, my understanding is that most of the time with criminal background checks is that most of the time they're looking for something specific. So, like, let's say you're working cash, and you, or you want to be working at a cash register, and their question is, like, have you had any convictions? And really, what they're looking for is fraud and larceny and things like that. But if you have something else, they may not care. It's just that it'll show up on the check. So at that point, if you lie about it, now you might be in trouble because you didn't disclose, even though it's not an important facet of your history.
I would agree with that. I mean, we always urge people to be honest on their applications because lies tend to do that. They tend to go down the road and then either get exposed or require other lies to continue on the story, which is just as bad. But that I don't think that's not something I could necessarily comment on. If a person is going to do sort of that surface check, I would suggest that a person be truthful about it and then try to have that conversation with them when it comes up. If an employer is enlightened enough to see that you have been convicted of assault, but you never stole anything, and that's okay with them, then, you know, that's the conversation that's going to have to hopefully take place around that and what the employer feels about that. But, yeah, it's fairly upfront. Those kinds of surface checks really have more to do with theft usually than how you're going to act with potential customers and things like that. So we were talking about disclosure and accommodation. So, well, let's just back up on accommodation. So accommodation is sort of a time-limited, a finite contractual thing that happens between an employee and an employer. The most important thing about accommodation is that it is not the easy way or allowing a person to get away with not doing all the duties in their jobs. It's more to eliminate barriers along the way that will allow the person to do the vast majority of their tasks and to do them better. So the examples, one of the things about accommodation is, as we've already said, that you have to state why you need the accommodation. And one of the areas that this is, we're always talking about is people frequently will give their diagnosis as a reason for the accommodation to take place, which we would advise against, because saying a diagnosis like depression or schizophrenia doesn't really inform anyone of what it means, and it's also going to be usually up to the interpretation of people, most of whom don't know actually anything about what those diagnoses mean. So what we encourage people to do is to talk about a symptom, a functional symptom that they need to get over, and that's really what the accommodation is about. So the accommodation could be as simple as a change of hours, and that change of hours, the reason for that may be because the certain medication regime that you're on makes you unbearably sleepy in the morning, and you haven't found a way around that to see maybe if there's a way of adjusting the shift to put it into a time of the day where you are more functional. That's just an example. It might be something to do with when you're learning or you're the task that you're doing, that you have a difficulty concentrating, and that difficulty concentrating is made far worse by being in a situation where there's a lot of traffic around you, a lot of people walking by, a lot of distractions. So that type of accommodation that may be that the person says, I'm really trying to learn this new task. I'm having difficulty focusing a little bit on it, and I find that being in this position in this desk exposes me to a lot of traffic, and it's just making the situation worse. I'm wondering if my desk could be moved further back in the office where there's less traffic, foot traffic. I think that would really help. So it would be an accommodation, would be sort of specific like that, specifically attuned to a symptom that the person's, but providing a potential solution to them doing their job as they should do the job. The other thing that we advise is that it isn't a fire and forget kind of thing, and that is that a person shouldn't just get that seat further in the office and stay there necessarily, because people that need accommodations don't need them all the time. So that's why there should be a time frame around it where the person sets a date with their supervisor and goes back and discusses the issue a month or 2 months down the road. The discussion would be around, is the accommodation working? Has it proved successful? Do we need something more? Has it overcome the barrier for that period of time and now you can move back? Or do we think another month or 2 months would do something else for us or carry us to the finish? That's the kind of discussion you would want. That's the other thing, too, we should point out, is that the discussion should be done in a very intimate way. It should be explicit about confidentiality, and that is, if you're having this discussion with your supervisor, it's important that everybody knows where this information is going to go, how it's going to be recorded, who else in the office will know about it. These are all important things to make the discussion safe for both the employee and the employer.
I've noticed that all the accommodations you mentioned so far, a change in shift schedule, arriving a little bit later, moving a desk, are all non-monetary investments. Would you say that most accommodations don't have a cost to them, and or can they get really expensive?
Well, we do use this in our mental health training, that the figure we use is around $500 for a non-physical accommodation. So these are typically adjustments in schedule, adjustments in shifts, longer learning times, things like that, which are really time-based, sometimes physically based, but you don't have to. The thing about mental health and addictions accommodations are that they're not physical, so you don't have to build a ramp, you don't have to change your washrooms, anything like that. It's more within the flow of the company, and the cost is really around how much time is going to be involved with it, not the purchase of any special stuff.
And so for employers, if you were going to give advice to somebody giving an accommodation rather than receiving an accommodation, what advice would you give to them on surrounding making that conversation approachable and best practices and things like that?
Well, I think it's important, as we've talked about before, that the space in which the conversation takes place is safe and confidential. It's not done out in the open, but rather in someone's office, perhaps the supervisor's office. The employer can be very helpful right off the bat by establishing a few of the factors that I talked about before, about what the conversation's going to be about, how is this conversation going to be recorded, who will know about it, just where the limits of confidentiality are. Not that every, and that's not expected that a supervisor will not report to their manager that they've had that discussion. It's just being explicit about how far the information is going to be going, and how it's going to be characterized as well, because sometimes people find that what they've said can be misconstrued. I think it's important for an employer to create this safe and confidential space as much as possible. I think we've talked about before that, sometimes if employers simply said to a person in the learning stage, how do you learn best? Do you find it helpful when you're learning something to receive it in a written form as well as just a verbal form? Those kinds of things, I think, could be helpful to any employee, not just those who may be actually seeking accommodation. So that would make it more comfortable. I think it would indicate to the person right off the bat that the employer is sort of a little bit in tune with the idea that accommodations do have. That's the thing. Accommodations are a right to expect within reason. The only reason why an employer wouldn't do an accommodation is if they could show that it caused undue financial hardship or to the running of the company or some kind of disruption. So, you do have the right to ask for accommodation. You also have the right not to disclose, but as we've already pointed out, if you're asking for an accommodation, it makes sense for you to say why you're asking for that accommodation.
Mm-hmm. But it can be talked about in the context of the job as opposed to some other reason. So, like what David was saying.
Functional.
Yeah.
How does it functionally help you do the job that you were hired to do? And that's really the key point of it. Not about how much, how long you've had a mental health problem or any of those kinds mm-hmm. of sort of irrelevant details to the situation, but in the situation, how can we help you improve your functioning? So.
And also, I think just to speak to the point that you had about it being a contract sort of thing. So if the employer makes sure that they revisit the conversation, to see, has this accommodation been working for you? Do we still need it? Do we need something else in place? So it's not just, like you said, a one-time discussion and then that's left after that. So,
just hang it out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that anyone who makes, has this kind of discussion at work is, in a way, is sort of paving the way for others who may want to have this discussion as well. So mm-hmm. it's sort of, if you don't have the perfect employer that's attuned into it and this is new to them, then you're breaking ground with them, but it is something that they are likely to encounter again in the history of the company. So, it's a good thing to do. Not just for you personally is what I'm saying. It's good for everybody.
As a greater.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do you have some do-nots? Any suggestions or, not suggestions, but anything that you've heard in the past that you know often does not work that you might want to put out there?
I would say one of the obvious issues up front is that in any business, small or large, it can be a hectic thing for all supervisors and all managers of all shapes and colors and all industries. Having personal discussions with people is not always their best strength. So sometimes, because of the context, employers or supervisors can sometimes bring up the issue on the fly. And I think that that's a definite no. The good thing is the impulse to want to have that discussion, but it needs to take place in a private spot. It shouldn't take place out in a room, even if it's a huge room and you're over in the sort of in the corner. It should be treated with the same kind of confidentiality you would want if you were going to your boss about any issue, taking a vacation or otherwise. You don't want to necessarily have that discussion in the middle of your teammates, right? Even if it's a sort of a non-threatening issue or perceived as non-threatening. So I would say that's the first thing. It's not a conversation to have on the fly in the room. So you need to make it private. And of course that goes along with the stuff I've repeated. So it needs to take place in a private place. It needs to take place in a situation where cell phones are off, phones are not answered.
No distractions.
No distractions. People are you have a good eye contact. It's not going to last a huge amount of time, but you need to have that sort of quiet, uninterrupted space to have a discussion like that. That's, I think, the foundation of making it safe. Mm-hmm. Over and above, of course, it does count what the person says and how they say it, but I think these other factors can be more important even than that, because it sort of sets the frame or puts the frame around the discussion as a special discussion, which it is. And so that would be my number one. Make it private, confidential. And obviously the follow-up. Make sure you're explicit about what's going to be done with this information.
Basically, it needs to be treated with respect, the conversation and discussion. That'll go a long way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't make it about people or character or whatever. Try to keep it functional. Mm-hmm. From the assumption that you've hired this person, and obviously when you hired them, you expected they would be the best candidate, maybe not with all the knowledge, but they would be the best candidate to fit in with your team, to train, whatever. Follow that assumption that they still are, even though they may be talking about some barriers that they're experiencing, but that's how they were hired. There's no reason to believe not. So make the discussion very functional. How, these were the things that we hired you on. This is the goal we still have for you. It's really about how are we going to reach that goal for you. So we already started out saying that we advise most people not to disclose that accommodations really when it's an absolute must. But I would certainly advise people, if they think going in that they're going to require accommodation, that unless they are able to read into the initial interview some incredible welcoming situation, or up front, for instance, a company has said that they're looking for people with self-reported disabilities or certain groups. If they've been explicit about that up front, that obviously that doesn't happen enough. But if it did happen, that would give you sort of free range to talk about it. But as a general rule, in that first interview, really all you're trying to do is get to the next interview or, get to the offer. And accommodations, serious accommodations for mental health histories, it's probably not the right time to do it. It's probably after you've had the offer anyway. If it can wait, perhaps after you've started the job and seen how the job was, because as we all know, in jobs, there are very few written rules given to you about a new job. That there are a few, but very few, that will tell you certain things about how to conduct yourself in the job and what your goals will be and stuff like that. There's a lot more unwritten rules, and you really do have to go and work in a place for a bit in order to sort of get the lay of the land and see how you're adapting. So I would say that any disclosure that takes place should hopefully be later on, at least in this realm. I mean, obviously, if you go to in physical disabilities, if you come in and you have an obvious physical disability, such as you're in a wheelchair or you're requiring a walker or a cane, then that's more likely to come up as a topic in maybe your initial interview. But beyond that, you want to just, you know, your purpose is really to convince the employer that you're better, as good as or better than the next person that's applying for this job, and that you're going to be an asset to them. So, yeah, the timing, I would say, is...
Not during an interview, ideally, and either after the offer within the first couple of weeks after you know the job.
Okay. Yeah, and that is when likely you are more likely to see the whatever symptom it is or whatever that might be interfering with you in the job. You know, chances are you may not need an accommodation, that it's simply a matter of time or receiving instructions several different ways or other kinds of adjustments that don't make any adjustment to the workplace. But if you do it, then at least you'll know what you're speaking of, because you'll have some sense of the duties by then. So.
Really appreciate your time. I think that this was very informative, and you covered all the bases. And yeah, and I really look forward to putting it out, and really appreciate your ability to do it.
Thank you for asking us.
A huge thanks to the Center for Addiction and Mental Health and David Odie and Tara Piercy for coming on Smash the Ceiling. I certainly look forward to partnering again on future projects. Lastly, and once again, don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Twitter, @PeerPathwaysTO, and I hope that you'll join us again next month as we connect with a local business who has incorporated social hiring into their business model. St. Stephen's Community House would like to thank United Way, as well as the Ministry of Advanced Education and Skills Development and Employment Ontario, for their continued support with this project. We would also like to acknowledge Monk Turner for allowing us to use Judicious Jude for our music, as well as Satunium for the percussive loop.